And we are on the air and you are listening to the Hallie Kesser-Jane Show. Let's talk. And I am Hallie Kesser-Jane. Welcome to my listeners in the United States and around the world. The Hallie Kesser-Jane Show is always available online at HallieKesserJane.com. Today, joy and narcissism are the two subjects we explore on the Hallie Kesser-Jane Show. When joining me at my table is Douglas Abrams, the co-author of The Book of Joy, Lasting Happiness in a Changing World, written with His Holiness the Dalai Lama and Archbishop Desmond Tutu, and Dr. Craig Malkin, author of Rethinking Narcissism, The Bad and Surprisingly Good About Feeling Special. Let's get right to it. We begin with Douglas Abrams. Now imagine two spiritual giants, Nobel Peace Prize laureate His Holiness the Dalai Lama, and Nobel Peace Prize laureate Archbishop Desmond Tutu. 5 days, one timeless question. How do we find joy in the face of life's inevitable suffering? The moderator, Douglas Abrams, friend, author, editor, and literary agent. The occasion, the celebration of His Holiness's 80th birthday. The place, the Dalai Lama's home in India. The year, 2015. The conversations cataloged by, yes, Douglas Abrams, and now available in the New York Times best-selling book, The Book of Joy. Let's talk. Doug, you there?
I am, Hallie. Great to talk with you.
Great to talk to you, too. Oh, my gosh. Let's just get going on this thing. Heady company that you keep, my friend.
These are two wonderful folks.
I mean, it's amazing. And what a great story. Lord, a Jew, a Buddhist, and an Anglican, right? All together in the middle of India or up on a mountain in India. And I just got to say, besides the fact that it's an amazing story, how the hell did this thing come together? This is extraordinary.
It is amazing. Well, we were actually at Archbishop Tutu's wife's 80th birthday in South Africa when a friend of mine who was the chairman of the Dalai Lama Foundation, Jim Doty, asked me what I thought about the idea of the Dalai Lama and Desmond Tutu writing a book together. And I've had the privilege of being the Archbishop's literary collaborator and more recently literary agent for the last decade. And so I said, wow, that sounds like an amazing idea, the two of them writing a book together. What would it be on? We both paused and then we looked at each other and we said, joy. Because these are two of the most joyful people on the planet. So we were actually having sandwiches with Archbishop Tutu, or as he's affectionately known as Arch, at his office. And so I turned to him and I said, hey, Arch, you want to write a book with the Dalai Lama? And he said, I'd do anything with that man. Because they just love each other. They call each other their mischievous spiritual brother. And what we didn't realize, I mean, we knew this was going to be a historic meeting. We knew it was going to be important and profound for the world. We really didn't understand until we got there how much it would mean for the two of them.
Which is an interesting part of the story, for sure. And we'll get to that. But this is something I just have to ask you this. Come on. Sure. We don't all of us get to be in the presence of such, oh my God, men, if you will. Men. I'm not even sure I would use the term men for either of those two people. But, you know, what was that? What does that feel like, honestly? Or are you too jaded? You've been around too long. But go back to...
Well, I have had the privilege of being with in the presence of lots of amazing people and working with a lot of extraordinary visionaries and luminaries. But you never get over the thrill of being with people who are so profoundly human and so deeply themselves. You know, that I think is the most amazing thing, is that they're both so incredibly humble and just exude this kind of well-being and aliveness that comes from their deep love and compassion and practices. And you feel it. I mean, it's palpable in the room. It kind of, you know, it's like you can't help but have it infect you. And, you know, I was very skeptical, and am very skeptical. I'm kind of a New Yorker by raising and training. And, you know, this, you know, people talk about being in the presence of great spiritual masters and having all these, you know, bodily effects. And I'm, you know, kind of like, whatever, you know, not very interested in it. But I will tell you, when I sat down to do those interviews and I started looking into their eyes, my whole head and body started tingling. in a way that I have not experienced before. Now, granted, it could have been the adrenaline, but it just felt like looking into the eyes of these two extraordinarily compassionate men for 5 days, that it was kind of rewiring my mirror neurons in some profound way.
You are one lucky guy. You must have good karma.
Well, it was a lucky, incredible experience, but we really didn't want it just to be about me or even all of us who were there. We really wanted the world to get to experience this. This was a historic meeting. It was a historic series of teachings as they were looking back on their lives and sharing from the deepest parts of their humanity. And so the book that they wanted to give for the Dalai Lama's 80th birthday was this kind of three-layer birthday cake that has their spiritual teachings and stories as one layer. But they also wanted it to include science as a second layer. You know, the Dalai Lama said, this can't be a Buddhist book, this can't be a Christian book, this has to be a universal human book. And they both are big proponents of understanding what science has to say, and they really wanted it to either corroborate or contradict what they had to say. And so we included a lot of the science of happiness and science of well-being, which has made incredible strides in the last years. Fascinating kinds of synergies between what they had to say and the, you know, alignment between their two very different world traditions and the science. That was amazing. And then the third layer was this travelogue experience of actually being there with them, because we really wanted readers all around the world to get to be that fly on the wall that I was, to be able to be there with them. And as you know from the experience of the book, you really feel like you're getting to be taught how to meditate by the Dalai Lama, or and witnessing him dance for the first time in his life. And that's been really gratifying to hear from readers. It doesn't feel like they're reading a sermon or even a Dharma teaching. It feels like they're sitting down and having tea and breaking bread with these two extraordinary human beings.
Let's talk about these two extraordinary human beings very briefly on this note. If I say the Dalai Lama, first word that comes to your mind?
Compassion.
And if I say Bishop Tutu?
Forgiveness.
I think that before we went forward, I wanted to make that clear. And I also want to say to you, you were right about this book, because first of all, this book, their power is so magical in this book that what you've just been speaking to comes forward in the book. I'm walking around with this sucker. Everybody around me is going, what is wrong with you? I said, I have to keep reading this. Every line in this book is so powerful. You want to read it over and over and over again. You guys did a great job on this. And I go forward, I want to say that how powerful this is. Everybody needs to have this on their bed table. Your job was to facilitate and capture the conversation, and that you were going to make it available for the world. And I do have to ask you this, because it is their story, but it is yours too, Doug. Don't undersell that, because you're me in that book. You're the my friend next door in that book. The responsibility of taking all of this down and helping put this into this project. I mean, did you understand the level of this responsibility? This will never happen again to these two men.
Well, we knew that this would likely be the last time that they might be together, given health and global politics. And it was an enormous responsibility and a daunting responsibility. And there were many dark nights of the soul for me, of whether I could do justice to it. And, you know, some dark mornings of the soul, some dark afternoons of the soul. But, you know, I really did feel like my job was to be there as the kind of curious and skeptical reader, saying, you know, like, okay, so how does that work? And how has that worked in your life? And one of the really gratifying things that we've heard from people is that they're kind of laughing and crying their way through the book, and that they're really feeling like they're knowing these two extraordinary people, not just as kind of, you know, these, you know, holy men, but as really as human beings. And they're sharing their lives and their stories with each other in such a profound way. It's really these two dear friends reflecting on these, you know, 80 plus years of life that they've lived, and, you know, everything that they've learned. And to have two of the most kind of dedicated spiritual practitioners and most moral figures to give us that vantage point and to remind us that it's something that we are all capable of cultivating and developing wherever we are on our own path, in our own human journey. It was just incredible.
Words that are peppered throughout the Book of Joy: giggle, laugh, tease. I was circling them every time they came up because I love those words. There's a childlike aspect to these two men, and therein lies one of the riddles of joy, correct?
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, in the eight pillars of joy, one of them is humor. And, you know, they said it's about, it is fascinating, they said it's, you know, about being able to laugh at yourself and laugh at life. And they said it's, you know, and even as they're teasing each other, you know, I said, you know, Archbishop Tutu, you know, the laughter that you're, you know, talking about here, the humor, you're not kind of belittling or putting down each other. And he said, yeah, it's a kind of humor that raises everyone up and together. And it says, you know, like, come stand next to me. This is how he described it. And we'll laugh at me, and then we'll laugh at you.
I love that.
This great way of, you know, and I, you know, I do think that there's kind of like a universal spiritual, you know, kind of development index that circles around, you know, that's dependent on laughter. And the, I mean, having worked with a lot of extraordinary luminaries, you know, the ones who have the greatest sense of humor are often the ones who are farthest down the path, or as Arch says, we're all masterpieces in the making. But, you know, he's, I'd say the more we can embrace that humor, the more of the masterpiece we become.
The phrase, the simple joys in life, that is in the seemingly innocuous day-to-day of life that joy is found. That's my experience. There are images that remain stamped on my mind after reading the book, The Dalai Lama and His Response to Eating Rice Pudding. I mean, the Archbishop Tutu and the rum raisin ice cream. And I love the Dalai Lama dancing. Talk to me about all of this, because I did mention childlike. There is this. Is it innocence? Is it childlike? Is it purity? Maybe it's all the above.
I think, you know, it is a kind of a childlike quality of joyfulness and playfulness and aliveness. You know, I think you see it in children. They have that kind of amazing delight in life. And then often that kind of gets beaten out of us or kind of, you know, depressed out of us. And they do have that. You know, the story that you were referencing in the, you know, about that sitting next to the Dalai Lama and having him, you know, turn to me with that bowl of Tibetan rice pudding and say, I love this. You know, I mean, it's just, it's such a kind of, it is the reveling in the simple pleasures of life. And I think, and the simple joys of life. And I think it's wonderful to remember that even these great holy men who may meditate 4 and 5 hours a day or pray 4 and 5 hours a day actually can, you know, are able to appreciate it more. It's not about a kind of renunciation about life. And at the same time, what they remind us is we need to go beyond just the kind of physical joys or happiness, you know, when, you know, we're just the Tibetan rice, you know, the rice pudding ends and the rum raisin ice cream ends. And we do face sorrow and hardship and suffering. And this book was really about not just kind of how do you be happy and joyful when everything's going well, but how do you face it in, you know, when there is real suffering or adversity that you're facing or that we're dealing with in our world. And that was kind of their profoundest teaching of, you know, and what we were really exploring is how do you do that?
Difference between joy and happiness.
Another wonderful question. So what they were saying is that the Archbishop said that, you know, joy is bigger than happiness, that in fact it subsumes happiness. Happiness is often seen as or experienced as we're going to be happy when, you know, we get that job, when we fall in love. It's very much goal-oriented or outer-directed. And, you know, that we're going to pursue these goals and that will make us happy. And what they explained is that actually true happiness, which is really joy, comes from within. It's the process. It's not just the goal. It's the experience of life and living life in a way where, you know, you see the world with the eyes of joy and that you're living, you know, the eight pillars of joy that they presented in the book. And that's when you experience joy. And one of the things, you know, our forefathers talked about the pursuit of happiness. And what they actually said is that, with all deference to our forefathers, that pursuit of happiness as an explicit goal is the fastest way to missing the bus. And in fact, it's not about pursuing happiness. It's about cultivating these other eight qualities, these other pillars of joy. And when you live with those in your life, then you are able to experience more joy and happiness.
The two men's journeys are filled with great paradox, like all of our lives certainly are. But let's discuss how it is that the very hardships that, in their case, they both have encountered, you know, the Dalai Lama's flight into exile, Nelson Mandela and Archbishop Desmond Tutu, and all of the apartheid nightmare in South Africa. These guys have been through it, needless to say. And Desmond Tutu, I think, has cancer now, right? He's been, I mean, so these guys are not immune from what the rest of us walking the face of the earth are immune to. And yet they both say something different than maybe the rest of us would perceive it. And that is that it is in the suffering, right? Or out of the suffering that comes joy. That's astonishing and gorgeous.
Yeah. I mean, it was really astonishing. I think I went into this thinking that my job in life was to try to minimize and push away the sorrow and the adversity and maximize the joy and the pleasure. And what they reminded us of is that those two, so joy and sorrow, are really two sides of the same coin, and you can't have one without the other. And actually, that adversity actually can often be a source of ultimately the greatest joy. And right at the beginning of the week, the Dalai Lama was telling this very moving and powerful story of his flight into exile. And Archbishop Tutu turned to him and he said, "Why are you not morose?" And the Dalai Lama didn't actually know what the word morose meant, so he's trying to figure it out with his translator. And the Archbishop Tutu said, "Why are you not sad? Here you are. You've been turfed out of your country, one of the greatest tragedies that anyone can face. You've lost your people. So many of your people have been put into exile or oppressed. And here you are, this source of radiance and joy that we see today." And the Dalai Lama looked at him, not to deny any of the truth of what he said about the suffering that he had experienced, but he said, "You know, my exile has been really quite enriching. It has gotten me closer to truth than I would have experienced if I had stayed as the Dalai Lama in the gilded cage in Tibet." I mean, which was just like our jaws dropped. You know, like here was a man who was able to reframe and see the benefit of 50 years of exile. And the Archbishop said, "You know, what you're saying to us is it's not that despite the suffering and the adversity that you have found such extraordinary joy. It's because of that." And Archbishop Tutu said this incredible thing where he said, "It's suffering can either ennoble us or embitter us." Right. So he talked about Nelson Mandela in prison for 27 years and how he was transformed by that experience. And, you know, oftentimes our suffering or our adversity does embitter us and people end up kind of crumpled and not joy filled like these two men. But if we can find meaning, this is what he said is the arbiter that determines whether we are embittered or ennobled by that suffering. If we can find meaning in it and use it in a way to benefit ourselves and others, especially others, that's when we turn that suffering into something that can be ennobling and not embittering.
You know, it's funny, the one thing that we as human beings crave most, I'm sure, is joy, right? Mm-hmm. And yet, we unwittingly, and I hope it's unwittingly, create our own obstacles to joy.
Yep.
Right. And the life there is, and in life, there are these things. There's fear, there's stress they talk about, and anger and grief and illness. And so to talk to me about that.
Well, so as we talked about that, you know, the book has these three parts, which is the nature of true joy, the obstacles to joy, which you're talking about now. And then the third part, which we've spoke a little bit about, the eight pillars of joy. And they really wanted to, you know, the book to live where people live, you know, not to be some kind of sermon on the mountaintop, kind of 10 commandments of what you should do in an ideal world, but really to deal with stress and frustration and anger and loneliness and envy and illness and adversity and even death. And so we kind of tackled each of those topics, which was really very powerful, and to hear how they address each of those issues and how they face them. And I think, you know, we do create a lot of our own suffering. And, you know, I grew up in a household that was shrouded by the black dog of depression. And I learned very early on that, you know, myself and others, we can create so much of our own suffering between our ears. Obviously, there's great suffering that people experience from, you know, poverty and violence and other things. But oftentimes, so much is determined by how we face that, those realities. And we either kind of compound that suffering or we alleviate and ameliorate that suffering. The Dalai Lama told this unbelievable story about one of the monks who had been taken away during the night that he fled from Tibet, from Lhasa, when the Chinese kind of started their bombardment, and he was taken to this Chinese gulag, where he said, you know, it was so cold that you would spit and your spit would freeze before it hit the ground. And it was, you know, they didn't have shoes. They were so cold. They were so hungry all the time that people turned to cannibalism. And he said he even once, you know, tried to bite into one of the dead bodies that was there, but it was so cold that it was frozen and he couldn't eat it. And so this man is telling this unbelievable story to the Dalai Lama of suffering and adversity. And, you know, he said, you know, I faced many dangers. And of course, the Dalai Lama said, he thought, of course, you know, this man's life was in jeopardy. It was whole, hanging in the balance at any moment. And the monk said to him, no, the danger that I faced was of losing my compassion for my torturers.
Wow.
And we are like, our jaws were kind of on the floor with this story and this amazing reminder of how this man who was in the face of this incredible kind of horrendous death camp and, you know, being tortured and all of, you know, on a daily basis, was able to keep his mind free. And, you know, a lot of people obviously suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder. And, you know, you would think that a lot of these monks would as well. And I actually heard, I haven't seen this, you know, the studies on it, so I can't say it's been validated in any way, but how many of these people have escaped some of that traumatic stress because of the way that they were able to face that adversity.
So leave me speechless now. Why don't you do that?
Yeah,
I mean, I really appreciate that.
Times, yeah.
Oh my gosh. So here's the thing. We did mention the 8 pillars of joy, and I don't want to give away this book because I want everybody to go get this book. So just know that there are answers that are just extraordinary in this book, and you all need to go and pick it up just because of the answers that are there. I'm teasing you. Do it. It's worth it. Trust me. That being said, we also talked about science a little bit, and I think that's a good thing. I just had Matthew Fox on the show a couple of weeks ago, and he was saying, you know, we got to stop separating science from the spiritual. Not a good thing. So I'm glad that we talked about that. And now I want to talk to you about meditation, because I've been reading a lot about meditation lately, and finally,
sure,
the scientific community is starting to realize the power of meditation. Sincerely,
yep.
Talk to me about that.
Yeah, it's really interesting. So, I had, the pleasure and the privilege of working with a lot of the incredible scientists in kind of the science of happiness and well-being studies. And Richie Davidson, who's a neuroscientist at Wisconsin and has studied a lot of the effects of meditation on the brain. We were out, you know, kind of having Vietnamese rolls in San Francisco as we were doing research for the book. And he told me this wonderful story about how we talked about the kind of brain changes that you see in the scans for these, these monks or others who have meditated seriously and consistently. It's quite amazing, you know, and the ways in which, you know, their limbic system, their amygdala, the kind of reactive anger centers or fear centers of the brain are kind of almost you know, embraced by these integrative neurons from the prefrontal cortex. So really incredible science. But then, you know, he also said to me, which is a wonderful story, he said, you know, well, the Dalai Lama said to me that he really finds the science beneficial when he's trying to get out of bed in the morning at 3 a.m. to meditate, knowing that it's going to really help his brain. Well, if the Dalai Lama needs science to help convince him to get out of bed, how much more so do we need it? And so, you know, I think that, you know, the meditation, you know, and I should say that in addition to kind of the three parts of the book, we also, they wanted to include their joy practices or the meditative and prayer practices and, daily practices that they use that to kind of tune their life and keep themselves, kind of trued, if you will, on the spiritual path and in, you know, in their lives. And one of the things that they talked about, you know, is, you know, that Archbishop Tutu said that, you know, when we're facing this suffering, we need to be like dishwashers, not like vacuum cleaners. You know, we need to not suck up all that suffering and that pain, and that whether it's in our own life or the ones we love or whether it's out in the world that we're witnessing in the headlines, and kind of hold on to it like a vacuum cleaner. We need to actually have these practices that allow us to process that pain and that sorrow, and then to pass it along through the pipes like a dishwasher, not hold on to it, and be ready and fresh for the next experience of our lives. And I think one of the things that the Dalai Lama was such an amazing example of is, you know, when you you're face to face, when you're looking in this incredibly compassionate man's face, and he's kind of, his mirror neurons are sparking, and actually one of the emotion scientists, Paul Ekman, that we work with, said that he has the most empathy and compassion of anybody he's ever studied or looked at. And he's got this just incredible kind of compassionate, empathic response to what you're feeling. And then, you know, you're gone and the next person is is facing him, and it's totally done. And that emotion, no matter what, that's experienced, it's gone, and he is ready to be present and with the next person and the next experience. And, you know, when we talk very much in the kind of, you know, in the meditation world, people talk about the power of the present moment, the power of now being present. And really what it's, you know, it is about is learning to be able to process that emotional experience in at such a speed that it's not like we don't have those emotions, but then we're not locked into them and we can truly be present for our lives and facing the reality of what's in front of us.
The last line of the book of joy. Our greatest joy is lived in deep, loving, and generous relationships with others. That's powerful stuff. I thought I'd like to have you comment on that.
Sure. I mean, I think that they were such, I mean, one of the other profound insights of this book is that the fastest way to experience joy is to bring it to others. And that actually it is our relationships with one another that are our deepest joy. And they, you know, really, they talked in such beautiful ways about how deeply connected we are to one another. And that the Archbishop quotes this traditional African phrase called Ubuntu, that we are who we are through one another, and that we shrivel without those relationships. And their relationship with one another, their profound friendship, was just this magnificent example of what's true for all of us, that those connections with one another, those relationships with one another, are the profound and greatest sense of our joy.
How are you now? Does this stay with you for the rest of your life? Or
you know, I don't think, honestly, that you can have that experience that I had, or that you can even read this book, as we're hearing from readers, and not be transformed and affected by it. And, you know, we've heard from people that it's helped them confront chronic pain. One reader told us that it had stopped him from committing suicide. I mean, just amazing reactions to being, you know, basically getting to be up close and personal and have this transmission of this profound wisdom and humanity. For me personally, you'd have to ask my wife to really know that, you know, how transformed I have been. But I will say that, I don't think that you can, I could be the same person I was before I started working on this project. And as I mentioned, this has been a kind of lifelong journey, the search for joy and understanding. And I think it's been one of the greatest privileges of my life to get to live this in my own life and share it with so many others.
I've been speaking with Douglas Abrams, who, along with His Holiness the Dalai Lama and Archbishop Desmond Tutu, bring us the Book of Joy. For more information, visit thebookofjoy.org. You are listening to the Hallie Kasser Jane Show. My guests today are Douglas Abrams, co-author, along with His Holiness the Dalai Lama, and Archbishop Desmond Tutu, of the Book of Joy, Lasting Happiness in a Changing World, and Dr. Craig Malkin, author of Rethinking Narcissism, The Bad and Surprisingly Good, About Feeling Special. Thanks so much for tuning in. In the age of President Donald Trump, the word narcissism is thrown around a lot, the president's detractors labeling him the king of narcissism. But what is narcissism? Is being labeled a narcissist always a bad thing? We reach back into our archives to bring you an important conversation with Dr. Craig Malkin, author of Rethinking Narcissism, The Bad and Surprisingly Good, About Feeling Special. Dr. Malkin, author, clinical psychologist, and instructor of psychology for Harvard Medical School, offers a radically new model for understanding what he asserts is an often misused term. With two decades of experience helping individuals, couples, and families, Malkin's articles, advice, and insights have appeared in Psychology Today, Marie Claire, Women's and Men's Health magazines, Huffington Post, and Oprah Winfrey is one of his greatest fans. He's been a featured commentator on NPR and Fox News. Let's talk. So, my friend, having come from a long line of narcissists and no doubt being one myself, good luck with you, sir, when talking to me in this conversation, Dr. Malkin. Should I call you Dr. Malkin? Do you like to be called the formal Dr. Malkin?
A lot of people call me Dr. Craig.
Dr. Craig, I'll call you Dr. Craig. But seriously, I couldn't wait to speak to you about this. This is groundbreaking material as far as I'm concerned. Rethinking Narcissism, The Bad and Surprisingly Good About Feeling Special. Define narcissism as most of us understand it.
Just to clarify, it's actually Rethinking Narcissism, The Bad and Surprising Good About Feeling Special.
Oh, okay. I'm glad that you got that correct. Talk to me.
And so, define narcissism.
Mm-hmm.
So one thing I want to get out of the way up front is that people can learn all about my perspective and the research if you go to thenarcissismtest.com. You can actually take the test online, a brief version of the research tool that we developed, and you can see how high or low you are in narcissism and get research back tips and feedback. And people love it. At last count, something like 38,000 people had taken it so far. But what we traditionally think of as narcissism, what comes to mind for most of us, and when we think of narcissists, is sort of the vain, boastful reality TV type, chest thumping braggarts. But the reality is that there are many types of narcissists, and there's lots of types of narcissism. You get too focused on that version of it, you're not going to understand the common core of what drives all narcissists. And what's interesting is what we discovered is if you look at the research, it appears that a part of it is a normal, pervasive human drive, the drive to feel special. That is how I define narcissism. And as soon as you define it that way, all kinds of things become clearer that were not clear before, including it's a lot easier to identify more subtle narcissists and protect yourself when necessary. You just think of this as a normal drive that's gone out of control. Narcissists are addicted to feeling special.
Addicted to feeling special. That's a fascinating way to put it. It's a term that is tossed around, however. And so on the largest spectrum of it all, we all have this broad definition, and it has a negative connotation. And the comma after your main title in the book is the bad and surprising good about feeling special.
Yes. Yeah. And it could have actually been called The Surprising Bad and Surprising Good, but that's a dreadful title. So because, again, this is the chief rethink. It really helps people recognize problems more easily. But let's get to the surprising good, because it's all part of coping. So over a quarter century of research shows that most people around the world feel a little bit special. They see themselves through slightly rose-colored glasses, and that helps them feel more optimistic, resilient, and persistent in the face of failure. It even helps them enjoy big dreams. It helps us give and receive in relationships. It's very helpful for our relationships. So we need that. Again, that appears to be just a part of human experience. It's when people turn away from love and relationships and towards feeling special in all kinds of ways, like for their looks or for their talent or even for being the most misunderstood person in the room, when they become addicted to being special, that's when they become narcissists. But on the other end, it's also clear from the same research that if people don't feel a little of that, see themselves through slightly rose-colored glasses, they suffer. In the research, they become at the extreme what I have dubbed echoists.
Love that word.
And that is from the myth of Narcissus and Echo. Echo was the nymph who could only repeat back the last few words that she heard someone say, and she fell in love with Narcissus. And much like Echo in the myth, people who struggle with echoism are afraid of standing out, afraid they don't have their own voice. They're afraid of seeming narcissistic in any way. They've often grown up or been raised by caregivers who are extremely narcissistic, and so they develop the stance towards life. If I want someone to love me, or if I want to feel connected, I have to take up as little room as possible.
That's sad. That's sad. But talk to me about this. Talk to me about, and again, we have to talk in broad terms because of the length of time that we have here. But what causes, quote unquote, bad narcissism?
Oh, well, there seems to be a genetic component.
Okay.
I believe that most personality is 50-50. That nurture and nature, that shows up in the research again and again. You have to have a predisposition towards a certain personality for it to develop, but there's going to be environments that bring it out. So in one huge longitudinal study that was over the course of 20 years, they actually found early precursors of unhealthy narcissism in preschoolers. It was signs like being constant rule breakers, always drawing attention to themselves, showing off, being extremely overdramatic. And when that showed up in preschoolers, they were more likely later on in life to show these signs of unhealthy narcissism. Again, when you're addicted to feeling special, it really means you're setting all other considerations aside, including what other people feel and want and need. But here's the good news. And I have a whole chapter in Rethinking Narcissism. This is part of the big Rethink 2. I have a whole chapter devoted to raising healthy, self-confident, caring children, kind of 8 keys for how to do that. Because what the same longitudinal research shows is that if you are responsive, even to kids like these, the ones who felt like their parents were there for them and understood them, talked to them about their feelings, helped soothe them when they were distressed, did not become narcissists later in life. They didn't show unhealthy narcissism. So there's an interaction. You have to have maybe a difficult temperament and then not very responsive parenting.
Neglect.
Certainly in the case of neglect and abuse, if somebody is already tending in this direction, they're far more likely to end up at the far end of the narcissism spectrum, where you find narcissists. And narcissist, by the way, is not a diagnosis. It means somebody who's higher in traits than the average person. Disorder is narcissistic personality disorder.
Right. And we're going to talk about that in a minute. But let me go off on a different tangent just for a second here. Yeah. You know that writer Tom Wolfe termed the boomers as the me generation.
Yeah.
And the millennials have been branded the most narcissistic generation ever.
Yes.
So talk to me about this. Are the baby boomers any more narcissistic than their predecessors? Have the millennials broken the bank on selfishness, or have we as a society, listen to me, lost a moral compass? Is there a moral component to all of this, if you will, a society that is, as a whole, is just stuck on me?
Well, I think there's a problem with people celebrating unhealthy narcissism. I want that to change. Too much attention to reality TV types.
Right.
And people modeling themselves after them. We've got politicians who are struggling so much with their own narcissism that they can't say sorry for insulting somebody, a war hero or a prisoner of war, no less, just for example.
My goodness.
I mean, there are plenty of examples.
Right, right.
I am not convinced there's a narcissism epidemic. I'm not alone. The research is based on shaky survey studies, largely college students who we already know from other research. They're the ones who tend to be highest in narcissism anyway. And by all accounts, if you look at other studies, that falls after the age of 25. The main thrust of the argument that narcissism is on the rise was based on that survey evidence with one tool that has come under heavy fire because it might be picking up a fair amount of health. So one researcher actually argued that we should call millennials Generation We because he found them to be more caring and connected on a larger global scale to the large community than any other previous generation. So he suggested not using that at all. What was supposed to be the nail in the coffin for the poor millennials was that narcissistic personality disorder had seemed to rise from 1% to 6% in a large scale study. That turned out to be wrong.
Okay.
It's still widely cited that the rate of NPD is 6%, and it is not. It turned out that that came about because the study was done by census workers collecting the information, and they found everybody was high on everything. There was too much OCD and too much depression, and there was too much everything. And so another group of psychologists came along and said, well, let's actually restrict this to people who are really unhealthy, and we wound up with the 1% again.
I'm going to go back to that in 1 second. Travel down this road with me. So you say that everyone falls somewhere on the spectrum of self-importance, and everyone falls somewhere on the scale between utter selflessness and total arrogance. You think that we're too focused on the outer edge of spectrums as a society these days? Do you know where I'm going? You understand that?
On both the lack of the healthy narcissism, that ability that I talk about in Rethinking Narcissism to see yourself for rose-colored glasses a little bit, and also narcissists. Is that what you mean?
Well, you know, we do tend to, we're a society that's driven in isms and oh my gods, and I'm looking for words, hyperbolic about everything. So that when we look at what was always the spectrum that you talk about so brilliantly in the book, but that we're focusing on the edges of that spectrum. So the whole world looks crazy rather than where you are trying to take us into the center where we all can find a place, that because it's all a part of us, this narcissism.
I would say that's absolutely true. Yes, we like extremes. We like to see the world in black and white, clear, distinct, either or categories. Either you're a narcissist or you're not. Worse, what we have now today is either you're a pathological narcissist or you're not.
Right.
And that's a problem, because what happens is people get very confused in their relationships when they see subtler signs, and they maybe feel hope where they shouldn't because they read all the blogs and they read the information out there saying that narcissists are evil through and through, and they're completely confused because they're not seeing it, even though they might be with somebody who's extremely narcissistic.
It's part of our narcissistic society. Okay, the a lot of two C's and S's in there.
Yeah, that's a tough one.
Oh my gosh.
I mentioned for people, if they want to take the test that went along with Rethinking Narcissism, if you do have trouble spelling, just go to drcraigmalkin.com and there's a tab for the narcissism test.
I can't tell you what I was typing up today, how many times I had to use the word thing on that darn word that drove me crazy. But, you know, it's like, it seems to me that's even part of the narcissistic society that we are today, that we can't see the gray. Yes, right? It's very bizarre.
And it leads to problems. I made a point in one article that I wrote for Huffington Post where I made the point that everybody is remarkably self-inflated these days about how narcissism-free they are, ironically.
I don't know. It seems to me if you are a narcissist.
I don't have any.
No, right, right? Or you know, there's the other spectrum. That's me. Like, just embrace it. It is who you are. And just go for it, babe. You know, as long as you're not hurting anybody in the process. I want to go back to the NPI, to the narcissism personality inventory. And this is a question that I have. It's the most widely used measure of narcissism in social psychological research, and it's based on the DSM, Clinical Criteria for Narcissistic Personality Disorder. And I want to bring it up in this term, that it seems to me that these days we want to classify everything. everything, Dr. Craig. I mean, everything is classified. It makes you a little nuts. I got this, I got that, I got, oh my God. Why are we wanting to do that? Why the need to brand? Because that may almost can, in a way, make a self-fulfilling prophecy. I will become a narcissist. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yes, absolutely. I think two reasons. I think we just touched on one, which is that when you are able to brand, and then you can point to it and say, that brand is not me, it can help you feel superior.
Part of narcissism itself. I love it.
Right. It's sort of, I would never be like that. And the reality is, when any of us, I have this one line in Rethinking Narcissism, rage makes narcissists of us all.
Right.
When we feel hurt, when we feel upset, we don't care at all what the other person is feeling. If we're angry enough, we lose all our empathy. So I see this as, again, a part of the rethink is to see this not just as something fixed at either extreme, whether it's too little or too much, but as something that we can slide around on and we can actually get help moving into a healthier place. I think the focus on the immediate branding also makes things simpler for people. They don't have to think about the complexity that's going on with someone, which can be helpful. Not take that away, for example, from the survivor community, many of whom have experienced abuse and have been very badly hurt by extraordinarily narcissistic people I call malignant narcissists. And it helps for them to have, this is just it, this is who these people are, so that they can have some distance and heal. It gets confusing because even the most extreme narcissist has good parts and bad parts, and sometimes you see the good. So I think having a really distinct category can also help us get distance when we need it.
One in two marriages ends in divorce. Does that have a lot to do with who we are and the kind of narcissistic society we are?
That statistic has been around for some time. I'm not, this is again where I'm not convinced. First of all, it's inflated by people who divorce multiple times. A lot of the people in that figure are people who get divorced over and over. I think we've become more apt to move on instead of doing the hard work in relationships. And it often does require hard work to try to reconnect with our partners. I'm a couples therapist.
I know. So that's why I wanted to ask you that question.
I see this all the time. And part of the problem is people get stuck in these interactions. They can't get out because it starts to feel too emotionally risky to do what's needed to change it. Meaning, to be concrete, we have to be able to say, I'm lonely, or I'm sad, I'm scared, you're important to me, and this is really, you know, that's why it hurts and scares me so much, in order to reconnect with our partners. And if we don't feel safe, we can't do that. We should, maybe when we get to NPD, talk about what I call the stop signs.
Talk to me about them now.
Okay, well, so what is narcissistic personality disorder? It was almost kicked out of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, that's the Bible of mental health, that's published by the American Psychiatric Association. It was almost kicked out because of all these confusions that there's so many different kinds of narcissism. It gets very difficult and very murky to decide how bad this person is in this area versus another. And then there's the whole problem of that's been around forever, that narcissism itself is not a diagnosis. That's why a classic text on the subject is called Disorders of Narcissism, because we've had all this evidence for an idea of healthy narcissism for some time. So you take narcissists who is that they don't trust they can turn to people and depend on them and expect that they'll hear and comfort them and help them feel good. They don't have the capacity for what's called secure love or secure attachment in the research. So instead of depending on people in any real authentic way, they depend on feeling special instead. That's in all kinds of ways, whether it's by being the most giving person in the room or the most misunderstood person in the room or the most attractive person in the room. There's all kinds of ways to feel special. This is why in Rethinking Narcissism, I wanted to streamline all of this and give it a common core. As soon as the addiction becomes strong enough, now other people people's feelings and needs don't matter. All that matters, like anyone who is addicted, narcissists use feeling special like a substance to soothe themselves instead of turning to people for love and caring and concern. And like anyone who's addicted, they'll lie, they'll steal, they'll cheat if they need to feel important. In other words, they'll do things like steal your ideas at work and pass them off as theirs. As soon as you get into that, what I call the three E's, exploitation, severe exploitation of other people to get your needs met and feel special, extreme entitlement, often accompanied by rage when they don't get what they want, and empathy impairment. Those are the core of narcissistic personality disorder. It is pervasive and without help. Again, the rate that I quote in Rethinking Narcissism that shows up in the research again and again is 1% of the population. That 1% doesn't have much hope of getting better without help.
But with help.
But with help, I see people with NPD, narcissistic personality disorder all the time. I'm through Skype or in my office. These are people who call up and they say, I feel like a monster and I'm ruining my relationships and my life and I want to change. It's that awareness that gives us some hope when the person is not in denial of their problems. Remember, I mean, if you're in denial of having an alcohol problem, you're not going to stop drinking.
Right.
If you're in denial that you're so addicted to feeling special, you can't even consider other people, you're not going to change.
This is an odd thing to say, maybe, in the context of this conversation, but it's a judgment, or one would take it as a judgment, to be called a narcissist, to be called, you know, somebody who's diagnosed with the disorder, if you will. That's so without compassion. We have compassion for people who have cancer. We have compassion for people who have other problems. But boy, I'll tell you, that narcissism brings out the worst and the most empathetic, I think. What are your thoughts?
It brings out the worst and the most what?
Empathetic. Even if you are an empathetic person, somehow we don't feel for people who are narcissists. We get nasty about narcissists.
Yes. Well, many extreme narcissists make it very hard. This is not rethinking narcissism. You're probably already, everybody can tell, is not an apology for narcissists. It's an attempt to help people on how to understand and cope, particularly by recognizing what drives it. And we can recognize that very often narcissists, especially people with narcissistic personality disorder, have been abused. They have been neglected. That's clear from the research that there's strong ties between being an abuser as an adult and having been abused when you were younger. We can recognize that there are people out there who've been very hurtful and they've traumatized others in their relationships and feel for the fact that they've become so lost.
Yeah, and I think that's an important point to make. And I wonder about love. If you've been a person who's been without love, who's been neglected, you know, the things that we were talking about that could be the cause of narcissism, does it work to give love, to help?
The answer is yes for some. Again, so this links to the three stop signs that I outline in Rethinking Narcissism. There are approaches that you can take to find out if there's some hope in the relationship, especially if the other person who's narcissistic is in therapy. But there are three stop signs, which are reasons to find help leaving a relationship. Not everyone with narcissistic personality disorder becomes an abuser, but some do. And if you have experienced physical or emotional abuse is name calling, put downs, being extremely controlling, that's reason to get help leaving. It doesn't matter if it's caused by a drug problem of some kind or narcissism, it's reason to get help leaving. I mentioned the other stop sign, it's denial. If your partner or friend can't even acknowledge and say, I think I'm in trouble here, I think I might need help, that is reason to get help in leaving the relationship. And yet a third sign is extreme psychopathy. Psychopathy is a cold, remorseless approach to relationships where often people who are extremely psychopathic narcissists would not hesitate to embezzle if it would help them feel better. They would not hesitate to have multiple affairs and lie straight to their partner about it. And the prognosis, the chances of things getting better in a relationship with someone who is psychopathically narcissistic or also known as a malignant narcissist are very small.
So,
but yeah, you wanted to get back to when there's the middle ground, when there's some hope. Correct?
Right. I did. I do. Yeah. Is there hope?
there is hope for some. So as long as you don't see those stop signs, what the research shows is that it isn't by calling people out on how arrogant and nasty they're being that they change. That's not surprising. If somebody tells you you're being a jerk, you're probably going to become more narcissistic. So what I often tell people who are struggling with this in their relationships is, if it doesn't work with you, it's not going to work with a narcissist.
Right.
Especially somebody who has narcissistic personality disorder. What seems to be far more effective, because what we're seeing in the research is, we used to have this idea that even people with extreme narcissism, narcissistic personality disorder, have zero empathy. That was a long-held belief. They just are incapable of empathy. You still see it everywhere on the internet from bloggers. And what the research shows is that's not true. It's turned out that narcissists of all kinds, no matter how extreme, have a capacity for empathy. They can be very caring, very empathic. Again, this is where it gets confusing. But when something troubles them, they feel preoccupied with something that bothers them, or their own needs become important, their empathy becomes blocked. So it's more properly understood as impaired or dysfunctional empathy. It fluctuates, you know, it vanishes. Suddenly you feel like the light was on you and then it got turned off. What you're looking for in the way of hope is somebody where when you speak to your partner in the right way, they can get how you're feeling. It can sort of switch on their empathy. So the easiest way, I think, that I give in Rethinking Narcissism, I don't want people to work really hard, paragraph-long statements that they have to make. I break it down into two simple things. First, affirm the relationship. You know, if your husband, your partner, you're the most important person in my life, which is why I feel devastated when you criticize everything I do, when I hear this constant criticism. I love you and I care about you and I want to feel like you look up to me, and it feels so bad. I feel so sad in these moments. So first, affirm the relationship and then speak from a vulnerable place. Our tendency in bad relationships is to either shut down in silence and tiptoe around, or lash out in rage. Those are the two most common patterns. And so what I do is teach people to test out some hope by learning to use these empathy prompts to see if their partner can be reached. If people are capable of empathy, they melt when they hear comments like this.
The word hope, I love that word. And I love the word dream. There's nothing wrong with dreaming. I mean, we think that dreaming is, you know, a bad thing. It's something that we can go for, but it can also get in the way. And in the conversation about narcissism, right? I don't know. I've read, you make mention of it. I won't say it as well as you do. Talk to me about dreaming.
Yeah.
And let's end on dreaming, because I think it's a positive.
Yes, absolutely. This is another aspect of it that I talk about in Rethinking Narcissism, the surprising good part that we all need to feel a little special, to feel resilient, and even helps us be closer in our relationships, because we view our partners through rose-colored glasses. And all of that is wrapped up in not being stuck in exactly how things are, but being able to reach for something more, whether it's dream of becoming an artist, or it's a dream of developing a new invention. When you look at people who have achieved these things, yes, there are plenty of people who feel like nothing and they feel worthless and also are able to produce, you know, but it feels a lot better not to have that. And a lot of people, what we found in our research is that people who are high in healthy narcissism answered questions in the affirmative. I like to dream big, but not at the expense of my relationships. Hmm. They were more likely to say yes to that question. And I talk about in Rethinking Narcissism too the whole problem of, if your message growing up, many people who struggle at the level of echoism where they have a lack of this ability to see themselves through rose-colored glasses, they were told, don't get ahead of yourself. Don't get a big head. You know, you're shooting too high. You're probably going to end up disappointed. In other words, their sense of ambition is discouraged. Hmm. And it's clear, we have this, most of us, if we're not neglected as kids, kids who are you ask a preschooler, five or somebody five or six who failed a test, how are they going to do on that same test tomorrow? And they'll say, great. we need a little of that. Even as an adult, what's interesting about that is that it's, you know, kids experience failure again and again and again. If they weren't able to dream, you know, if they aren't able to at least imagine that they're going to ace that test tomorrow, what a miserable experience they're going to have always expecting to fail. So I think that's one of the reasons, and it's probably almost wired into us to approach things this way. And as adults, it often helps to achieve beyond the ordinary, to at least believe that you can do something beyond ordinary long enough until you get information that tells you otherwise and you have to adjust your expectations. That was the key difference between people high in healthy narcissism and those in extreme narcissism. People high in healthy narcissism will take in information and adjust. Okay, that didn't work. I made a mistake, but I want to keep doing this. I want to try.
Fascinating conversation. Fascinating subject in this Facebook, Google Plus Twitter world, which I call the neo-narcissism breeding grounds. You've written a very important book. I've been speaking with Dr. Craig Malkin, author of Rethinking Narcissism, The Bad and Surprisingly Good, About Feeling Special, by way of Harper Wave, an imprint of HarperCollins. For more information on Dr. Malkin and his work, visit www.drcraigmalkin.com. Find him on Facebook and Twitter under Dr. Craig Malkin. Thanks so much for tuning in to The Hallie Kesser-Jane Show, a production of RESEC, LLC. The Hallie Kesser-Jane Show posts new podcasts Wednesdays, 3 p.m. Eastern. Visit HallieKesserJane.com.